me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Listen, I've been giving some thought on Doug Pike.
Yeah.
And I must confess, we're talking about events of 40 years ago.
Well, I understand that.
My memory's getting a little limited on it. Most of it I remember are personal contacts, personal relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
Some business relationships. I do remember very faintly interviewing Doug for VOA, Voice of America, and bringing him on board.
That's my general understanding, too. Myrna may help us on that.
Myrna may help. And I believe that was while I was program manager of The Voice from 56 through 61.
Uh-huh.
Doug came aboard basically in our central services division, newsroom, talks, and so on.
Uh-huh.
He was not the conventional journalist, news writer. He was more, pardon the use of the word, an intellectual.
Uh-huh.
But a very good one and a very active one. Then, with obvious qualifications, joined the Foreign Service.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm aware, Vietnam was his only Foreign Service post.
I think his biography shows three or four others, but I don't know exactly how they...
If they were, they were short-lived.
Yeah, right. They were short-term sort of deals.
He was in Vietnam, in Saigon, when I went there in February of 64.
Okay, yeah, he had been there since 61.
Right. And to the best of my memory, he was the only one I really knew on that staff.
Really?
And was very, very, helpful in introducing me, breaking me in, if you will.
Now, was this VOA?
Doug? No. I was then assigned, I had been in India.
Uh-huh.
As Deputy Public Affairs Officer, and then was assigned as Public Affairs Officer in Saigon.
Yeah.
So
by then, Doug had transferred to USIA, am I right?
Right.
Okay.
Well, and the Foreign Service, as you know, was called USIS,
uh-huh.
U.S. Information
okay.
Service.
Okay.
But he was in a special role in the embassy in Saigon, specializing on the political side, on the VC, on the what was then almost all VC.
Mm-hmm.
The NVA, North Vietnamese Army, didn't get involved until a little later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Doug, when I arrived there, was the first one to have me for dinner, he and Myrna at their apartment. And that's where I met my first Vietnamese, one of whom I had lunch with the other day, Bui Zi M, who was then publisher, owner of the Saigon Post,
mm-hmm.
and eventually became American Vietnamese ambassador to the U.S., who now lives in Washington. And he is a guy, if I haven't said this to you, I probably should have. You ought to talk to about Doug.
I'll try to, sure.
He knew Doug quite well. Bui Zi M, B-U-I, new word, D-I-E-M.
Uh-huh. Any relation to the GM family?
No. Bui Zi M was a northerner who came down at 50, in the 54
uh-huh.
mm-hmm. exodus from North Vietnam after the Geneva agreements.
Yeah.
Doug was our brain. Doug was, in terms of political analysis of the VC and the opposition within Vietnam. His work was extremely helpful. It was to the operation of our information, internal communications programs,
mm-hmm.
but was also very useful as a resource to the media
right.
in Vietnam, mm-hmm. who respected his knowledge, would often talk to him, and to other agencies of the government in Vietnam.
Right.
The structure in Vietnam was quite unusual and evolved eventually into something that was unique, I guess. A mission council where the heads of the agencies met once a week, sort of expanded, if you will, country team.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And Doug would be a resource for all of them.
That includes the CIA.
Including the CIA, certainly feeding them.
Yeah.
He worked with them, not for the CIA, but with the CIA. Mm-hmm. I don't think, well, I'm quite sure he was never on CIA payroll.
Right.
And he was never formally part of the CIA. Mm-hmm. But the CIA considered him,
mm-hmm.
and I may be mistaken on that, but the CIA considered him almost part of their team.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Because he did an awful lot of work on whatever information and documentation was available. Captured documents, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And that became eventually the expert on the VC.
That's true.
More than anyone else in the mission.
I don't want to interrupt your line of thought, but at what point do you think his input, his studies, his analyses begin to make an impact at higher levels of the ambassador on the scene to the extent that they were being fed back to Washington?
Well, hard to measure,
yeah.
hard to know. It was a sort of evolving, growing knowledge and information. He would certainly brief the ambassador periodically, and heads of other agencies.
Right. Who was ambassador when you arrived?
When I arrived, Henry Cabot Lodge was ambassador.
Okay, right.
Followed the, if you remember,
okay.
Lodge was being discussed as a potential presidential candidate.
That's right.
Lodge left in June of 64 to come back and help Bill Scranton, who was even more prominent as a candidate. Mm-hmm. Although people forget Lodge's picture was on the cover of Time in those days when Time would have a person every week on the cover.
Uh-huh.
And as a potential candidate, the picture was Lodge with the rice paddies behind him.
Uh-huh.
He came back to join and help. Lodge beat, if I remember, won the New Hampshire primary in the spring of 64.
Mm-hmm.
Being from Massachusetts, he had a special appeal in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
But he came back not to run for as a candidate himself, but to help Bill Scranton from Pennsylvania,
uh-huh.
ex-Governor Scranton. That didn't work out very well.
Didn't he wind up vice presidential candidate with Goldwater?
He wound up vice presidential candidate with Richard Nixon.
Oh, Nixon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's right, 64.
Again, people forget how close that 64 election was.
Mm-hmm.
There are those who, Lodge was the vice presidential candidate in 1960.
Right.
Nixon.
Yeah.
People forget how close that election was.
Yeah, right.
Evaluation of the election that said if Mayor Richard Daley hadn't
lost
a lot of votes in the Chicago River, the Illinois River, Nixon would have won.
Yeah, Nixon said, okay, forget it.
Yeah.
He walked away from it.
Right.
But anyway, do you think that Pike was giving Lodge input at that point?
By then, Lodge. Although Lodge didn't Lodge was not, because of all the troubles that had been held in the embassy, Lodge was not that receptive to outside advice.
Uh-huh.
He did his own analysis and evaluation.
Right.
But there's no doubt, he got some from Doug.
Right.
Lodge was replaced by Maxwell Taylor.
Uh-huh.
Came out in, my dates may be off a couple of weeks, but June or July of 64.
Mm-hmm.
Taylor was there for 1 year to command, and I use that word advisedly, the four stars Taylor had on his
right.
uniform always shined through his civilian clothing.
Yeah.
And Taylor certainly turned to Doug every so often. Not on a regular basis, but but for reading, on the particularly on the political side of the VC. And as things went on of the NVA, of the entire North Vietnamese.
Yeah.
Taylor lasted a year, and then Ellsworth Bunker came in. And Ellsworth was there for, what, 6-7 years, replaced finally by Graham Martin. But
I
don't have the date when Doug was finally transferred back to the States.
I have that somewhere, but I know he was there when Bunker was there.
Yeah. But he came back and he wrote that book. He had worked on a lot of the material while he was still in Saigon.
Yeah. That was, he was on leave from USIS?
Yeah. He went to
Foreign Service gave him leave so he could
right,
go to.
He had leave, and I think he was attached to one of the universities. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. It was MIT where he went. He thought about getting his doctorate and decided, well, no, just go ahead and write this book.
Yeah. And the book had quite an impact. It was the first and certainly the best book on the VC.
Yeah. Called Viet Cong Strategy of Terror, was that the name of it?
Mm-hmm.
That made an impact. That sort of made his name. It was reviewed in the New York Times, I'm told.
Yeah,
and he was clearly stamped as the Viet Cong expert,
and there was, I have to say, there wasn't a hell of a lot of competition.
Yeah,
there was a lot of superficial evaluation of the VC, but Doug had it in depth, and I don't know that many others. The only ones I would put even close to Doug. May have been Bob Chaplin of the New Yorker, who was very, very good on the political side of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And there may have been a Bernie Fall in his untimely death about Indochina in general. But not many others. In fact, none others that I think of offhand.
Right. Now, tell me, when did you leave Vietnam?
I left, I know the exact time, July 7th, 1 o'clock, 1968.
68. Right.
At 4.5 years, 1 month short of 4.5 years there.
We were having a big, things were really heating up in 68.
Well, we were past the Tet Offensive.
Yeah.
When I had Vietnam, there were something like 23,000 American military there, a couple of hundred, 300 or 400, maybe a few more civilians. But the effort, the U.S. effort, was a combined civilian-military effort.
Mm-hmm.
When I left Vietnam, we had over 500 to whatever it was, 70,000
right.
military there, obviously. The military dominated by then. This was after the Tet period.
Right.
And Tet was the end of my war. I stayed on a few months the ambassador and Westy wanted me to, my agency replaced me mm-hmm. as PAO. Mm-hmm. The ambassador kept me on as special assistant for media relations and then asked if I'd take over the ICOR as the senior American there. Mm-hmm. But by then, I'd been separated from my family for 3 years, except for occasional visits to the Philippines.
Yeah. Now, you went,
finally decided
that was
my war was over, time yeah. to leave.
When you went to there in 64, what was your title?
Public Affairs Officer, head of USIS.
All right, and then when you left, though, it was different.
When I got there, and I've got a letter from Ed Murrow assigning me there, telling me job was appointed, so on, saying the one thing I have to say to you is Henry Cabot Lodge has told me and my deputy Don Wilson a number of times, he's his own press officer, always will be, always has been, and that I would have nothing to do with the media. I could run the USIS program. That was February. In June, there was so many difficulties with the media. Westmoreland by then...
June of 64.
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Westmoreland by then had taken over from Paul Harkins.
Yeah.
Or about to. I think he took over July 1st. Lodge and Westy agreed and recommended at a meeting in Honolulu, which was co-chaired by McNamara and Rust,
mm-hmm. yeah.
to appoint me, put me in charge of all media relations. And the NSC issued a directive, of which I still have a copy, appointing me the public affairs advisor to both the ambassador and the commanding general of MACV, Westmoreland.
Uh-huh.
And this was by name. As far as I know, that's the only time the NSC has ever done that.
Yeah. Now, was that the creation of Juspal?
No.
Okay.
I got that assignment in June, actually in July, I guess the directive came out, of 64. But I was still head of USIS. However, we had a coordinating committee for communications, for psychological operations,
yeah.
which consisted of USIS, AID, and MACV. The head of AID there in the communications area, not AID overall, was a fellow named Ralph Boyce,
yeah.
whose son right now is ambassador to Thailand, mm-hmm. had been ambassador to Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
And a Lieutenant Colonel Bowen, who later became a Major General. We three agreed that this didn't make sense to have separate organizations working the same field. So we recommended that they all be merged into one organization.
Mm-hmm.
Carl Rowan, who was then directed by then director of USIA,
right.
came out on a visit about March of 65 or so. And by then, U.S. troops were coming in,
mm-hmm.
combat units. Picked up on that and came back to Washington and recommended and got approval from the president and the agencies involved for the joint U.S. Public Affairs Office, JUSPAL.
Right.
And I was appointed director of that. JUSPAL didn't come into being formally, officially, until July 1st, 65.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a separate assignment from being the minister counselor for information on media relations. Actually, I had two hats in Vietnam. One was minister counselor for information, which was chief spokesman, media relations. The other hat was director of JustPow, of the Joint U.S. Public Affairs Office. Organizationally, they were separate assignments, obviously merged together. But I had deputies for each of them, quite separate ones. And that went on from the 65 through spring of 68. You use up your credit in these jobs, and and a lot of people weren't happy with what they thought I was catering to the press too much. I'd been there too long. So the USIA replaced me as director of USIA. Director of JustPow, the guy named Ed Nickel, came up. The ambassador kept me on as special assistant for media relations, for communications. When I left, I was replaced by a State Department officer in the media job, and JustPow, the communication job, went its own way until, I think, 72, when the whole withdrawal came, and JustPow was abandoned, went back to USIS the last 3 years, 72 to 75.
I don't mean to interrupt, but...
I was just going to say, 72 to 75, it was a more conventional structure of USIS.
How did Doug's progression, or did his job titles change from the time you were there until the time you left? Did his role must have stayed about the same.
His role stayed about the same, but was more formalized. I don't know what the hell it was technically when I got there, probably part of the information division. But it soon became clear that his contribution and his role should be distinct. And he was simply our political analyst.
That's a good enough title then.
Yeah.
Okay. And he dealt not only with people in the government, in the various agencies, but he helped the press when they came out. Don Oberdorf has told me how valuable Doug was when he...
Well, he was. You know, he was...
But he collected all of this stuff.
That's right, and he would spend a lot of time briefing not only journalists, but State Department people and military people and so on.
In the after hours, how'd they spend their time? You mentioned social things.
Our families were evacuated in February of 65. My own family went to the Philippines to Brent School up in Baguio in the Philippines.
As well as the American troops were about to arrive. Is that it?
Well, American troops were about to arrive, plus the VC had hit the... attacked a number of times in Saigon itself. The war was obviously cranking up to a new level. So Taylor decided to get dependents out of there. That left us all, not there were women stationed there, but that left us all without families. The job itself was much closer to a 24-hour-a-day job. There wasn't that much time for social activities, but there were a number of them. There were receptions and cocktails. And one of the things that got underway, and Doug and I were avid and original members of the what became almost a legendary poker game, Friday nights in my residence.
In your house?
In my house. We played for a long time. USIA types were in there. Journalists sometimes took part. There used to be a charge that the journalists were feeding us winnings in order to get information.
They could have been just incompetent players.
we just claimed they weren't very good poker players. Doug was a very good poker player.
Yeah, yeah.
The table on which we played when I left was left behind.
Uh-huh.
Doug Pike, was it Doug Pike or Vlad Frasher? But that table came back to Washington. The game revived here in 1975 when I moved to Washington. Mm-hmm. We started playing on that same table. And very often played at Doug's house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Until he finally left, went out to California.
Yeah.
Mm. And that game still goes on.
Does it? Yeah.
Most Friday nights, with three of the early players are still in it, myself and two other former USIS types.
Yeah. When it was going on in Saigon, were there some names that would be recognizable to the public who played?
Oh, probably not. Yeah. The journalists would come in and out. What was his name of Associated Press? Would play?
Peter, not Peter Arnett or Malcolm Brown?
No, they weren't, but their colleague, God, I'll think of a name in a minute.
George MacArthur was there.
George MacArthur was there. He didn't play very much. Mm-hmm. I saw him, but I'll think of his name. He ended up for AP in Boston, now retired.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Lou Chiavi of ABC, I remember there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you go along, more names will come back.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the makeup of the game changed from one Friday night to another, depending on who was around.
Yes, it did.
Well, was this Penny Ante or...
Oh, no. It was a pot limit game.
Yeah,
yeah. It got fairly substantial.
So you could win or lose 10 or more?
Oh, you could win or lose a couple of hundred.
Yeah, yeah. Where was your house, and describe it for me? You said the game took place...
Well, initially, I was in what had been the PAO's house.
Uh-huh.
If I remember the address, it was 8 Li Kui Dong. It was a townhouse originally by some French plantation manager. Big house, a lot of property. Living in it all alone didn't make a hell of a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
When my family left. We then had an attack on our USIS library downtown during one of the protest rallies. And the USIS library, which was on the ground floor of the, not the Briggs building, what was the hell the name of that building, was really sacked.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted out of that big house. It was too visible.
Yeah.
Well, not very efficient. So we made the house the library. It was big enough to serve that purpose. And I got a house that had belonged at one time, I think, to Esso.
Oh.
But the address was 5 Dong Kong Bu. Many years later, in 1995, when Margaret and I went to visit, I just wanted to see the house for sentimental reasons, and they wouldn't let me in. There were guards at either end of the short block it was on. The VC had taken it over, or the North Vietnamese government had taken it, as a guest house for visiting intelligence people. It was their equivalent of CIA had taken it.
What year would this have been?
Well, that was 95.
95.
I'm back. It was. Now, I lived in there alone, but usually an incoming USIA officer, before we could get quarters for him, would stay with him, and for a good long time, one of my deputies, who was our liaison to the Vietnamese government, John McGowan, lived with me. Then Gene Rosenfeld lived with me for a while. And it was, and I'd have household briefings. Our poker games would be out there. But usually on Thursday nights or Wednesday nights, I would have an background briefing by one of the principal officers of the mission for a very limited group of journalists, representatives of each of the bureaus and so on. And those were very candid briefings, very straightforward. Also, sometimes would get visitors, too. Among them was General Wally Green of the
Marines.
I remember well, as well as a number of other people. But also, at one time, Henry Kissinger.
Really?
Who was out there on a mission from the White House to explore the prospects of some kind of a negotiated peace.
Do you think you talked to Pike?
Kissinger? I honestly don't know, Bob.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if he did.
These thoughts are going to come to me kind of at random, but do you know if Pike had personal contacts with Robert McNamara at times? I say that he mentioned to me once going to McNamara's house.
Well, again, it wouldn't surprise me specifically, no. But it would have been a, you know, a scheduled event. It would, it would not have been a unique or
not a stage briefing.
No,
I didn't mean that. Were there? Can you recall a time when Doug's findings or conclusions got him in hot water or caused controversy? I think I'm thinking about Huey and what happened there.
I think Doug's briefings of the structure of the VC and the influence of the North. On the VC, the power plays within the VC organization, their approach and the relative impact of various personalities on their side, probably was counter at times to CIA's evaluation. It wasn't a long-running feud like the CIA and the military, and MACV. CIA and MACV always different.
Well, now, is this because the CIA thought there was more of a Civil War element to it than...
Yeah, and the CIA put much more credence on the VC's determination and ability to continue. The military approached things with very little experience in this kind of a counterinsurgency war on pure military, pure military factors. And the military came up with a crossover point, you know, where the casualties on the BC would be greater than the North Vietnamese or that the other side could replace. I think the figure they had was about 100,000 a year. Whereas CIA tended to say, no, they've got much more determination readiness to keep going regardless of the amount of sacrifice. And that, in many ways, our great mistake in Vietnam was underestimating the commitment of the BC and North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, yeah.
And their readiness to keep going despite enormous loss of sacrifice.
Let me get this straight. Did Doug sort of differ with CIA on this point of how long the VC could do it on their own?
I don't remember that as a sticking point on
okay.
that basic thing.
Okay.
But on who was playing what kind of a role within
okay.
the VC structure.
And when the North Vietnamese began to take the more dominant role. Is
right.
That, oh, I see. Okay. I see.
Doug had the best reading on the internal political elements, factors, influences within the VC.
Uh-huh.
Who was calling the shots, who was had influence, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, did he base his knowledge strictly on paperwork that he saw, documents?
Well, he had to. He captured documents, but also probing North Vietnamese broadcasts, occasional interviews with
defectors?
Defectors.
Or captives?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Did he make it a practice, or did he often talk to VC?
He would talk to VC. I don't think it was a major part of his time. CIA and the military were not that anxious to have outsiders, quote, talking to their captives.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, Doug seemed to work like a dog. I saw him here at the Vietnam Center when he worked. It tended to be here 7 days a week, and I guess that's pretty much what he did in Saigon.
He worked like a dog. He had enormous files.
Yes, we have them now. Thank goodness.
Well, those files he brought back to the States. I remember in his house, he had a hole in the basement, a whole room
uh-huh.
of files, all well organized. Then he took them all out to Berkeley, of course.
Yes.
And then took them down to Lubbock.
Yeah. We have them here at the Vietnam Archive. And I went back to college and got a master's degree 3 years ago and wrote my thesis based on a suggestion that Doug gave me before he died, which was, you know, you might take a look at that Viet Cong propaganda. There's all sorts of stuff over there. And he was right. They're just tattered little remnants of things, and there's some polished propaganda, and there are leaflets, and all sorts of things that he brought back. And
Doug was also influential in our propaganda, if you will, our messages.
Yeah.
And probably could claim originating one of our basic messages to the North Vietnamese that said, in which all of our leaflets and posters, born in the North to die in the South.
Yes, I remember seeing something like that. Yeah.
I've still got some of that stuff. If I ever get this stuff of mine down to Lubbock, you'll have some. But some of the posters, we used to come out with posters.
Uh-huh.
At Tet, the Trung sisters, and Lee Loy, what was his name? The Year of the Horse, we have a very attractive poster. I've got framed, and my son has it on his wall in Connecticut and so on.
Mm-hmm. This is an off-the-wall question, but I'm just thinking about Doug as a person, a personality. Did he have the beard when you arrived in 64?
I don't remember. I grew the beard later, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I won't swear on that, but
you know what his taste ran to in the way of music or anything personal things about him that sort of stood out? Was he a snappy dresser?
No, not particularly. And physically, as you know, he was, what shall I say, rotund.
A little bit rotund. Well, you like that food, I understand, Chinese.
Doug really, you know, he was a quiet guy. He wasn't very, very loud.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And he was what, in our framework, passed as an intellectual, and he really was an intellectual in in the true sense of the word. He was certainly not athletic. He certainly was not physically active.
I had the question there, and it just got away from. Oh, when he worked briefly for the Washington Star, and of course they wanted some punchy, headline-grabbing stories, and they found that he was writing things that tended to be too intellectual, may not have been the word, but maybe too in-depth or too thoughtful, or they weren't snappy. In other words,
they weren't snappy. He wasn't that. He loved to have dialogue. He loved to talk, discuss things, argue them out.
Yeah, he could tell a good story, too. I mean, he could illustrate a point with a story.
That's right.
I know he talked about going to see Lyndon Johnson one time. I've forgotten who took him there. It was a congressman from, maybe it was Burdick. And I guess Doug had been back and had written this book, and Burdick took him over there, and Lyndon was talking about the Viet Cong, he said, go over there and do what you have to do, and we need to know this. And Doug said, asked Pike, what do you need? And Pike said, well, I guess what we really need is time. And he said, Lyndon banged his fist down on the table and said, God damn it, one thing I don't have is time. I think this was 65 or so, I'm not sure.
Well, that sounds typical.
Yeah. What time is he going to be, by the way, there?
Here?
Yeah, I don't have a watch on.
Oh, it's 4:09. I have.
4:09 by your time?
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're... Can you think of anything else we ought to be covering in this interview?
No, I'll say this, Bob. If I do...
Yeah.
I will certainly get back to you.
Yeah,
I'm committed to getting all my papers together, and I confess it's sheer laziness, procrastination.
That Edward R. Murrow letter, be sure and include that.
Well, I've talked to, what was his name, Steve?
Maxner, right?
And I said, look, I've been talking about writing a book for 35 years now and haven't done it. I suspect I won't.
Yeah.
But I've put together speeches, articles, things I've done, oral histories I've done, and all the papers I have, plus that equivalent of the early bird that I told you about.
Right.
And... are you interested in any of that? And he said, sure. But this just the short part of this letter. Murrow, quoting Lodge, says, Lodge put the following language in his telegram accepting me. Mr. Zorthian should understand that he will not have responsibility for press relations, newspaper, magazine, television, radio, as I do this work myself. Mr. Joseph C. Luman, his embassy press officer, with his office in the USIS building, where there are convenient practical facilities for journalists. Then Morrow speaking, this is the way Lodge has been operating, and this is the way he intends to continue. He has made the point to me and Don Wilson on several occasions that I have always been my own press officer and always want to be. This we simply have to accept. The job will not be easy, but in many ways it is the most important job any PAO is called upon today to do. I'm confident you will feel it with distinction. Best of luck.
Oh, that's good.
Sincerely, Edward R. Murrow.
That's good. Did it reek of cigarette smoke by any chance?
But my point is that may well have been my greatest achievement in Vietnam, is to have Lodge recommend me to take over the whole media relations thing by June.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, listen, Barry, I may have come back to you with specific questions from time to time.
But, oh, they're only asking
me to. This certainly is very helpful, and I appreciate it, and I appreciate your time.
Let me give you one other thing. This is the Joint State Defense AID USIA message.
Okay.
The president has approved the decision to place one man in overall control of dealing with the American and foreign press in Saigon and of prosecuting a vigorous program to assure that true story of our efforts is reported in the United States and elsewhere. The appropriate agencies here have spelled out the decision in the following details. Barry Zarathian, President Lee, Country Public Affairs Officer, will assume the responsibilities of overall press counselor. He will retain the title of Country Public Affairs Officer with jurisdiction over the total information effort. He will delegate such of his responsibilities as he considers necessary to his deputy in order that there be no lapse in the execution of all our information program. Mm. Mr. Zarathian will serve both the ambassador and Comus McVie in their contacts with American foreign correspondents. They can look to him for advice concerning the desirability of seeing certain correspondents, et cetera, et cetera.
What's the date there on that?
That is dated June 6, 1964.
64. That's quite a few years ago.
Yeah, it sure yeah. is.
Well, all that stuff is very valuable and will be needed. And boy, the early bird things that you have and the other documents, researchers, historians can come in here and look at that stuff and piece together what they choose to piece together. But it's really valuable, and I know it's appreciated here.
Well, as I say, sheer laziness.
Well, I can relate to that. I've had my own book, you know, that I was going to write for years and never got around to do it. Well, listen, let me just close, but I can need a tag on this little piece of audio here, which says, it's been Bob Horton interviewing Barry Zarathian about Douglas Pike and other things relating to Juice Powell in Saigon and the Vietnam War, and it is January, 2005. Barry, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bob. Don't hesitate to call.
Appreciate it. Be talking at you.
I will get back to Texas Tech one of these days.
I hope you do. Look forward to seeing you.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks.